He'd met types like this before, and they were hopeless in New York City. Pendergast leaned forward and said quietly, "The blood splattered on the wall was rather interesting." DeGusta looked over.
"You don't say."
"I'd be interested in the ballistics on that blood." DeGusta looked straight into Pendergast's pale eyes.
"Good idea," he said finally. "Hey, photographer, get a close-up series of the blood on the wall. And McHenry, sir. I want a ballistic analysis done on that blood. Looks like it was moving fast at a sharp angle. I want the source pinpointed, speed, force, a full report." "Yes, sir. I want it on my desk in 30 minutes.
McHenry looked a little unhappy.
"Okay, Pendergast. Any more ideas?"
"No, that was my only one."
"Let's go."
In the temporary command post, everything was in place. DeGusta always saw to that. Not one piece of paper was loose, not one file was out, not one tape recorder sitting on a desk. It looked good, and now he was glad that it did. Everyone was busy, the phones were lit up, but things were under control. Pendergast slipped his lean form into a chair. For a formal-looking guy, he moved like a cat. Briefly, DeGusta gave him an overview of the investigation.
"Okay, Pendergast," he concluded. "What's your jurisdiction here? Did we fuck up? Are we out?"
Pendergast smiled.
"No, not at all. As far as I can tell, I would not have done anything differently myself. You see, Lieutenant, we've been in the case from the very beginning, only we didn't realize it." "How so?"
"I'm from the New Orleans field office, New Orleans, Louisiana. We were working on a series of killings down there, some very odd killings. Not to get into specifics, but the victims had the tops of their skulls removed and the brains extracted. Same modus operandi."
"No shit. When was this?"
"Several years ago."
"Several years ago? That's..."
"Yes, they went unsolved. First it was the ATF, because they thought drugs might have been involved. Then it was the FBI, when ATF couldn't make any progress. But we couldn't do anything with it. The trail was cold. And then yesterday I read a wire service report about the double murder here in New York. The M.O. is too peculiar not to make an immediate connection, don't you think? So I flew up last night. I'm not even officially here, although I will be tomorrow."
DeGusta relaxed. "So, you're from Louisiana. I thought you might be some new boy in the New York office."
"They'll be here," said Pendergast. "When I make my report tonight, they'll be in on it. But I will be in charge of the case."
"You? No way, not in New York City."
Pendergast smiled. "I will be in charge, Lieutenant. I've been pursuing this case for years, and I am, frankly, interested in it." The way Pendergast said interested sent a strange sensation down to Gusta's back.
"But don't worry, Lieutenant. I am ready and willing to work with you side by side in perhaps a different way than the New York office might. If you'll meet me halfway, that is. This isn't my turf, and I'm going to need your help. How about it?"
He stood up and held out his hand.
"Christ," DeGusta thought. "The boys in the New York office will take him apart in 2.5 hours and ship the pieces back to New Orleans."
"Deal," said DeGusta, grasping his hand. "I'll introduce you around, starting with the security director, Ippolito. Provided you answer one question. You said the M.O. of the New Orleans killings was the same. What about the bite marks we found in the brain of the older boy? The claw fragment?"
"From what you told me about the autopsy, Lieutenant, the M.E. was only speculating about the bite marks," Pendergast replied. "I'll be interested to hear the salivase results. Is the claw being tested?"
Later, DeGusta would remember that his question had been only half answered. Now he simply replied,
"It's being done today."
Pendergast leaned back in his chair and made a tent of his fingers, his blonde white hair hanging loosely over his forehead, his eyes looking off into space. I'll have to pay a visit to Dr. Zevich when she examines today's unpleasantness.
Say, Pendergast, you aren't by any chance related to Andy Warhol, are you?
I don't care much for modern art, Lieutenant.
The crime scene was packed but orderly, everyone moving swiftly and speaking in undertones, as if in deference to the dead man. The morgue crew had arrived, but was standing out of the way, patiently observing the proceedings. Pendergast stood with DeGusta and Ippolito, the museum's security director.
"Indulge me, if you will," Pendergast was saying to the photographer. "I'd like a shot from here, like this."
Pendergast demonstrated briefly.
"And I'd like a series from the top of the stairs and a sequence coming down. Take your time. Get a nice play of line, shadow, and light going. Do an Edward Weston. Make it pretty."
The photographer looked carefully at Pendergast, then moved off. Pendergast turned to Ippolito.
"Here's a question. Why was the guard, what did you say his name was, Mr. Ippolito, Jolly, Fred Jolly, down here in the first place? This wasn't part of his rounds, correct?"
"That's right," Ippolito said.
He was standing in a dry spot near the entrance to the courtyard, his face a poisonous green.
DeGusta shrugged.
"Who knows?"
"Indeed," Pendergast said.
He looked out into the courtyard beyond the stairwell, which was small and deep, brick walls rising on three sides.
"And he locked the door behind himself, you say. We have to assume he went outside here, or was headed in that direction. The torrid meteor shower was peaking at about that time last night. Perhaps Jolly here is an aspiring astronomer, but I doubt it."
He stood still for a minute, looking around. Then he turned back toward them.
"I believe I can tell you why."
"Christ, the real Sherlock Holmes," thought DeGusta.
"He came down the stairwell to indulge a habit of his, marijuana. This courtyard is an isolated and well-ventilated spot, a perfect place to, smoke some weed."
"Marijuana, that's just a guess."
"I believe I see the roach," said Pendergast, pointing into the courtyard. "Just where the door meets the jam."
"I can't see a thing," said DeGusta. "Hey, Ed, check out the base of the door. Right there. What is it?"
"A joint," said Ed.
"What's the matter with you guys? Can't find a fucking joint? I told you to pick up every grain of sand, for Christ's sake."
"We haven't done that grid yet."
"Right."
He looked at Pendergast.
"Lucky bastard. Probably wasn't the guard's joint anyway."
"Mr. Ippolito," Pendergast drawled, "is it common for your staff to use illicit drugs while on duty?"
"Absolutely not, but I'm not convinced it was Fred Jolly that—" Pendergast shut him up with a wave of the hand.
"I assume you can account for all these footprints?"
"Those belong to the guard who found the body," said DeGusta.
Pendergast bent down.
"These completely cover any local evidence that may remain," he said, frowning. "Really, Mr. Ippolito," he said, "you should have your man better trained in how to preserve a crime scene."
Ippolito opened his mouth, then closed it again. DeGusta suppressed a smirk. Pendergast was walking carefully back underneath the stairwell, where a large metal door stood partially open.
"Orient me, Mr. Ippolito. This door under the stairwell goes where?"
"A hallway."
"Leading to?"
"Well, there's the secure area down to the right, but the killer wouldn't have gone that way because—"
"Excuse me for contradicting you, Mr. Ippolito, but I'm sure the killer did go that way," Pendergast replied. "Let me guess. Beyond the secure area is the old basement, am I right?"
"Right," said Ippolito.
"Where the two children were found."
"Bingo," said DeGusta.
"This secure area sounds interesting, Mr. Ippolito. Shall we take a stroll?"
Beyond the rusty metal door, a row of light bulbs stretched down a long basement corridor. The floor was covered in shabby linoleum, and the walls were hung with murals of southwestern Pueblo Indians grinding corn, weaving, and stalking deer.
Lovely, said Pendergast. A shame they're down here. They look like early Fremont Ellis.
They used to be in the Hall of the Southwest, said Ippolito. It closed in the '20s, I think.
Ah, said Pendergast, scrutinizing one of the murals. It is, Ellis. My heavens, these are lovely. Look at the light on that adobe facade.
So, said Ippolito, how do you know?
Why, said Pendergast, anyone who knows Ellis would recognize these.
I mean, how do you know the killer came through here?
I suppose I was guessing, said Pendergast, examining the next painting. You see, when someone says it's impossible, I have this very bad habit. I can't help myself. I immediately contradict that person in the most positive terms possible. A very bad habit, but one that I find hard to break. But, of course, now we do know the killer came through here.
How?
Ippolito seemed confused. Look at this marvelous rendition of old Santa Fe. Have you ever been to Santa Fe? There was a momentary silence.
No, said Ippolito.
There is a mountain range behind the town called the Sierra de Sangre de Cristo. It means the Blood of Christ Mountains in Spanish.
So?
Well, the mountains do look quite red in the setting sun, but not, I dare say, that red. That's real blood, and it's fresh. A shame, really, it's ruined the painting.
Holy shit, said DeGusta, look at that!
A broad streak of blood was smeared waist-high across the painting. You know, murder is a messy thing. We should find traces of blood all along this corridor. Lieutenant, we'll need the crime lab people in here. I think we have your egress, at any rate. He paused. Let's finish our little tour and then call them in. I'd like to go ahead and look for evidence, if you don't mind.
Be my guest, said DeGusta.
Careful where you walk, Mr. Ippolito. We'll be asking them to check the floors as well as the walls.
They came to a locked door marked restricted. This is the secure area, said Ippolito.
I see, said Pendergast. And what exactly is the point of this secure area, Mr. Ippolito? Is the rest of the museum insecure?
Not at all, the security director replied quickly. The secure area is for storing especially rare and valuable objects. This is the best protected museum in the country. We've recently installed a system of sliding metal doors throughout the museum. They're all linked to our computer system, and in the event of a burglary, we can seal off the museum in sections, just like the watertight compartments on a...
I get the picture, Mr. Ippolito. Thank you very much, Pendergast said. Interesting. An old copper-sheathed door, he said, examining it closely. DeGusta saw that the copper covering was riddled with shallow dents.
Fresh dents by the look of them, Pendergast said.
Now what do you make of this? He pointed downward.
Jesus H. Christ,
breathed DeGusta, looking at the lower section of the door. The wooden doorframe was scored and gouged into a welter of fresh splinters, as if something with claws had been scrabbling at it. Pendergast stepped back. I want the entire door analyzed, if you please, Lieutenant. And now to see what's inside. Mr. Ippolito, if you would be so kind as to open the door without getting your hands all over it.
I'm not supposed to let anyone in there without clearance.
DeGusta looked at him in disbelief.
You mean you want us to get a damn warrant?
No, it's just that...
He forgot the key, said Pendergast.
We'll wait.
I'll be right back, said Ippolito, and his hurried footsteps echoed down the corridor.
When he was out of hearing, DeGusta turned to Pendergast.
I hate to say it, Pendergast, but I like the way you work. That was pretty slick, the painting and the way you handled Ippolito. Good luck with the New York boys.
Pendergast looked amused. Thank you. The feeling is mutual. I'm glad I am working with you, Lieutenant, and not one of these hard-boiled fellas. Judging from what happened back there, you still have a heart. You're still a normal human being.
DeGusta laughed. No, it wasn't that.
It was the fucking scrambled eggs with ham and cheese and ketchup I had for breakfast. And that crew cut. I hate crew cuts.
15. The herbarium door was shut, as usual, despite the sign that read, "Do not close this door." Margot knocked. "Come on, Smith, I know you're in there." She knocked again, louder, and heard a querulous voice.
"All right, hold your horses, I'm coming."
The door opened, and Bailey Smith, the old curatorial assistant of the herbarium, sat back down at his desk with an enormous sigh of irritation and began shuffling through his mail. Margot stepped forward resolutely. Bailey Smith seemed to consider his job a gross imposition, and when at last he got around to things, it was hard to shut him up. Normally, Margot would have merely sent down a requisition slip and avoided the ordeal, but she needed to examine the Kirabitu plant specimens as soon as possible for her next dissertation chapter. Moriarty's write-up was still unfinished, and she'd been hearing rumors of another horrible killing that might shut the museum down for the rest of the day. Bailey Smith hummed, ignoring her. Though he was nearly 80, Margot suspected he only feigned deafness to annoy people.
"Mr. Smith," she called out, "I need these specimens, please."
She pushed a list over the countertop, "right away, if possible." Smith grunted, rose from his chair, and slowly picked up the list, scanning it disapprovingly.
"May take a while to locate, you know. How about tomorrow morning?"
"Please, Mr. Smith. I've heard they might close down the museum at any moment. I really need these specimens." Scenting the chance to gossip, the old man became friendlier.
"Terrible business," he said, shaking his head. "In my 42 years here, I have never seen anything like it. But I can't say I'm surprised," he added with a significant nod.
Margot didn't want to get Smith going. She said nothing.
"But not the first, from what I hear. And not the last, either."
He turned with the list, holding it in front of his nose.
"What's this? Muhlenbergia Dunbari? We don't have any of that."
Then Margot heard a voice behind her.
"Not the first."
It was Gregory Kawakita, the young assistant curator, who had accompanied her to the staff lounge the previous morning. Margot had read the museum's bio of Kawakita. Born to wealthy parents, orphaned young, he had left his native Yokohama and grown up with relatives in England. After studying at Magdalen College, Oxford, he moved to MIT for graduate work, then on to the museum and an assistant curatorship. He was Frock's most brilliant protege, which made Margot occasionally resentful. To her, Kawakita didn't seem the kind of scientist who'd wish to be allied with Frock. Kawakita had an instinctual sense for museum politics, and Frock was controversial, an iconoclast. Despite his self-absorption, Kawakita was undeniably brilliant, and he was working with Frock on a model of genetic mutation that no one but the two of them seemed to fully understand. With Frock's guidance, Kawakita was developing the extrapolator, a program that could compare and combine genetic codes of different species. When they ran their data through the museum's powerful computer, the system's throughput was reduced to such a degree that people joked it was in hand calculator mode.
"Not the first what?"
asked Smith, giving Kawakita an unwelcoming stare.
Margot flashed a warning glance at Kawakita, but he continued.
"You said something about this murder not being the first."
"Greg, did you have to?" Margot groaned sotto voce. "I'll never get my plant specimens now."
"I'm not surprised by any of this," Smith continued. "Now, I'm not a superstitious man," he said, leaning on the counter. "But this isn't the first time some creature has prowled the halls of the museum. At least that's what people say. Not that I believe a word of it, mind you."
"Creature?" asked Kawakita.
Margot gave Kawakita a light kick in the shins.
"I'm only repeating what everyone's talking about, Dr. Kawakita. I don't believe in starting false rumors."
"Of course not," said Kawakita, winking at Margot.
Smith fixed Kawakita with a stern glare.
"They say it's been around a long time, living down in the basement, eating rats and mice and cockroaches. Have you noticed there aren't any rats or mice loose in the museum? There should be. God knows they're all over the rest of New York, but not here. Curious, don't you think?"
"I hadn't noticed," said Kawakita. I'll make a special effort to check that out. And then there was a researcher here who was breeding cats for some experiment, Smith continued. Sloan, I think his name was, Dr. Sloan, in the animal behavior department. One day a dozen of his cats escaped, and you know what? They were never seen again. Vanished. Now that's kind of funny. You'd expect one or two at least to show up.
Maybe they left because there weren't any mice to eat, said Kawakita.
Smith ignored him. Some say it hatched from one of those crates of dinosaur eggs brought back from Siberia.
I see, said Kawakita, trying to suppress a grin. Dinosaurs loose in the museum.
Smith shrugged. I only say what I hear. Others think it was something brought back from one of the graves they've robbed over the years. Some artifact with a curse, you know, like the King Tut curse. And if you ask me, those fellows deserve what they get. I don't care what they call it, archaeology, anthropology, or hoodooology. It's just plain old grave robbing to me. You don't see them digging up their grandmother's graves, but they sure don't hesitate to dig up somebody else's and take all the goodies, am I right?
Absolutely, said Kawakita.
But what is that you said about these murders not being the first?
Smith looked at them conspiratorially.
Well, if you tell anybody I told you this, I'll deny it. But about 5 years back, something strange happened.
He paused for a minute, as if to gauge the effect his story was having.
There was this curator, Morrissey or Montana or something. He was involved with that disastrous Amazon expedition. You know the one I mean, where everyone was killed. Anyway, one day he simply vanished. Nobody ever heard from him again, so people started to whisper about it. Apparently a guard was overheard saying that his body had been found in the basement, horribly mutilated.
I see, Kawakita said. And you think the museum beast did it?
I don't think anything, Smith responded quickly. I'm just telling you what I've heard, that's all. I've heard a lot of things from a lot of people, I can tell you.
So has anyone seen this, creature? Kawakita asked, unsuccessfully stifling a smile.
Why, yes, sir. A couple of people, in fact. You know old Carl Conover in the metal shop? 3 years ago now, he says he saw it. Came in early to get some work done and saw it slouching around a corner in the basement. Saw it right there, plain as day.
Really? Said Kawakita. What did it look like?
Well,
Smith began, then stopped. Even he finally noticed Kawakita's amusement. The old man's expression changed.
I expect, Dr. Kawakita, that it looked a bit like Mr. Jim Beam, he said.
Kawakita was puzzled.
Beam? I don't believe I know him.
Bailey Smith suddenly roared with laughter, and Margot couldn't help grinning herself. George, she said, I think he meant that Conover was drunk.
I see, said Kawakita stiffly. Of course.
All his good humor had vanished.
Doesn't like having the joke turned on him, Margot thought. He can dish it out, but he can't take it.
Well, anyway, said Kawakita briskly, I need some specimens.
Now wait just a minute, Margot protested as Kawakita pushed his own list under the counter. The old man eyed it and peered at the scientist.
Week after next, okay? He asked.
16. Several floors above, Lieutenant Augusta sat in a huge leather sofa in the curator's study. He smacked his lips contentedly, propped one chubby leg upon the knee of the other, and looked around. Pendergast, absorbed in a book of lithographs, was reclining in an armchair behind a desk. Above his head, in a gold rococo frame, hung a massive Ottoman painting depicting the mating ritual of the snowy egret. Oak paneling with a century's patina ran along the walls above a beadboard wainscot. Delicate gilded lights of hand-blown glass hung just below the pressed tin ceiling. A large fireplace of elaborately carved dolomite limestone dominated one corner of the room.
Nice place, Augusta thought. Old money, old New York, it has class. Not the place to smoke a two-bit cigar.
He lit up.
It's come and gone 2:30, Pendergast, he said, exhaling blue smoke. Where the hell do you think Wright is?
Pendergast shrugged. "Trying to intimidate us," he said, turning another page. DeGusta looked at the FBI agent for a minute.
"You know these museum big shots. They think they can keep anybody waiting,"
he said finally, watching for a reaction.
"Wright and his cronies have been treating us like second-class citizens since yesterday morning."
Pendergast turned another page.
"I had no idea the museum had a complete collection of Piranesi's forum sketches," he murmured.
DeGusta snorted to himself.
"This should be interesting," he thought.
Over lunch, he'd made a few surreptitious calls to some friends in the bureau. Turned out they'd not only heard of Pendergast, but they'd heard several rumors about him. Graduated with honors from some English university. Probably true. A special forces officer who had been captured in Vietnam and had later walked out of the jungle, the only survivor of a Cambodian death camp. DeGusta wasn't sure about that one, but he was revising his opinion nevertheless. Now the massive door opened silently, and Wright came in, the security director at his heels. Abruptly, Wright sat down opposite the FBI agent.
"You're Pendergast, I suppose," the director sighed. "Let's get this over with."
DeGusta sat back to watch the fun. There was a long silence while Pendergast turned pages. Wright shifted.
"If you're busy," he said irritably, "we can come back another time."
Pendergast's face was invisible behind the large book.
"No," he said finally. "Now is a good time."
Another page was leisurely turned, then another. DeGusta watched with amusement as the director reddened. "The security director isn't needed for this meeting," came the voice from behind the book. "Mr. Ippolito is part of the investigation." The agent's eyes suddenly appeared over the spine of the book.
"I'm in charge of the investigation, Dr. Wright," Pendergast said quietly. "Now, if Mr. Ippolito would be so kind..."
Ippolito glanced nervously at Wright, who flicked his hand in dismissal.
"Look, Mr. Pendergast," Wright began as the door closed, "I've got a museum that needs running, and I don't have much time. I hope this can be brief."
Pendergast laid the book open carefully on the desk in front of him.
"I've often thought," he said slowly, "that this early classicist stuff of Piranesi's was his best. Do you agree?"
Wright looked utterly astonished.
"I fail to see," he stammered, "what that has to do with—" "His later work was interesting, of course, but too fantastical for my taste,"
Pendergast replied.
"Actually," said the director in his best lecture voice, "I've always thought—"
The book slammed shut like a shot.
"Actually, Dr. Wright," Pendergast said tightly, his courtly manner gone, "it's time to forget what you've always thought. We're going to play a little game here. I'm going to talk, and y'all are going to listen, understood?"
Wright sat speechless. Then his face mottled in anger.
"Mr. Pendergast, I will not be spoken to in that manner."
Pendergast cut him off.
"In case you haven't read the headlines, Dr. Wright, there have been 3 grisly murders in this museum in the last 48 hours. 3. The press is speculating that some kind of ferocious beast is responsible. Museum attendance is down 50% since the weekend. Your staff is very upset, to put it mildly. Have you bothered taking a stroll through your museum today, Dr. Wright? You might find it edifying. The feeling of dread is almost palpable. Most people, if they leave their offices at all, travel in 2s and 3s. The maintenance staff is finding any reasons it can to avoid the old basement, yet you prefer to act as if nothing is wrong. Believe me, Dr. Wright, something is extremely wrong."
Pendergast leaned forward and slowly folded his arms on top of the book. There was something so menacing in his deliberateness, so cold in his pale eyes, that the director sat back involuntarily. DeGusta unconsciously held his breath. Then Pendergast continued.
"Now we could handle this in 1 of 3 ways," he said. "Your way, my way, or the Bureau's way. So far, your way has been far too much in evidence. I understand that the police investigation has been subtly obstructed. Phone calls are returned late, if at all. Staff are busy or not to be found.
Those who are available, such as Mr. Ippolito, have not proven particularly useful. People are late to appointments. Why, it's enough to make a man suspicious. As of now, your way is no longer acceptable.
Pendergast waited for a response. There was none, and he went on. Ordinarily, the Bureau's way would be to close the museum, suspend operations, cancel exhibitions. Very bad publicity, I assure you. Very expensive to the taxpayers and to you. But my way is a bit more hospitable. All other things being equal, the museum can remain open. Still, there will be certain conditions. Number one, he said, I want you to assure total and complete cooperation of museum personnel. We will need to speak to you and other senior staff members from time to time, and I want total compliance. I will also need a list of the entire staff. We want to interview everyone who works in or has had any reason to be in the vicinity of the murders. There will be no exceptions. I would appreciate your making sure of this personally. We'll be setting up a schedule, and everyone is to show up on time.
But there are 2,500 employees, began Wright.
Number two, Pendergast continued. Starting tomorrow, we're going to be limiting employee access to the museum until such time as this investigation is concluded. The curfew is to be for the safety of the staff. At least, that is what you will tell them.
But there's vital research going on here that...
Number three. Pendergast casually pointed three fingers, Derringer-like, at Wright. From time to time, we may need to close a museum, either fully or in part. In some instances, only visitors will be denied entry. In others, the museum will be closed to staff as well. Notice may be short. Your cooperation will be expected.
Wright's fury mounted. This museum is closed only 3 days a year, Christmas, New Year's, and Thanksgiving, he said. This is unprecedented. It will look terrible.
He gave Pendergast a long, appraising look.
Besides, I'm not convinced you have the authority to do that. I think we should...
He stopped. Pendergast had picked up the telephone.
What's that for? Wright demanded.
Dr. Wright, this is growing tiresome. Perhaps we should discuss this with the Attorney General. Pendergast started to dial.
Just a moment,
said Wright. Surely we can discuss this without involving other people.
That's up to you, said Pendergast as he finished dialing. For heaven's sake, put down that phone, Wright said angrily. Of course, we'll cooperate fully. Within reason.
Very good, Pendergast said. And if in the future you start to feel that anything is unreasonable, we can always do this again. He replaced the receiver gently.
If I'm going to cooperate, Wright continued, I think I've a right to be informed about just what's been done since this latest atrocity. As far as I can see, you've made precious little progress.
Certainly, Doctor, Pendergast said. He looked at the papers on the desk. According to your time clocks, the most recent victim, Jolly, met his demise shortly after 10:30 last night, he said. The autopsy should confirm this. He was, as you know, lacerated in a fashion similar to the previous victim's. He was killed while making his rounds, although a stairwell where he was found wasn't part of his normal route. He may have been investigating a suspicious noise or something of that nature. He may have just stopped for some reefer. A recently smoked marijuana cigarette was found near the archway directly outside the stairwell exit. We will naturally be testing the body for drug use.
God, that's all we need, said Wright. But haven't you found any useful clues? What about this wild animal business? You...
Pendergast held his palm up and waited for silence.
I would prefer not to speculate until we discuss the available evidence with experts. Some of these experts may be from among your own staff. For the record, we found no signs as yet that any kind of animal had been in the vicinity. The body was found lying at the bottom of the stairwell, although it was clear that the attack occurred near the top, as blood and viscera were found along the length of the stairs. He either rolled or was dragged to the bottom.
But don't take my word for it, Dr. Wright, Pendergast said, picking up a manila envelope from the desk.
See for yourself.
He pulled out a glossy photograph and laid it carefully on the tabletop.
Oh, my God, Wright said, staring at the photograph. Heaven help us.
The right-hand wall of the stairwell was covered with splattered blood, Pendergast said. Here's a photograph. He handed it to Wright, who slid it quickly on top of the first.
It's a simple matter to do a ballistics analysis on splattered blood, Pendergast went on. In this case, the evidence is consistent with a massive blow directed downward, instantaneously disemboweling the victim.
Pendergast replaced the photographs and checked his watch.
Lieutenant DeGusta will be checking in with you to make sure that everything is proceeding along the lines we've discussed, he said.
One last question, Doctor. Which of your curators knows the most about the anthropology collections here? Dr. Wright seemed not to have heard. Finally, he said,
Dr. Frock,
in a barely audible voice.
Very good, said Pendergast.
Oh, and Doctor, I told you earlier that the museum can remain open, all other things being equal. But if anybody else dies inside these walls, the museum will have to be shut down immediately. The matter will be out of my hands, understood?
After a long moment, Wright nodded.
Excellent, Pendergast replied. I'm very aware, Doctor, that your superstition exhibition is scheduled to open this coming weekend, and that you have a large preview planned for Friday evening. I'd like to see your opening proceed unvexed, but everything will depend on what we discover in the next 24 hours. Prudence may require us to delay the opening party.
Wright's left eyelid began to twitch.
That's quite impossible. Our entire marketing campaign would be derailed. The publicity would be devastating.
We shall see, Pendergast replied. Now, unless there's anything else, I don't think we need keep you any longer.
Wright, his face drained of color, stood up and, without a word, walked stiffly out of the room. DeGusta grinned as the door closed.
"Softened up that bastard nicely," he said.
"What's that again, Lieutenant?" Pendergast asked, leaning back in the leather chair and picking up the book with renewed enthusiasm.
"Come on, Pendergast,"
DeGusta said, looking cagily at the FBI agent.
"I guess you can drop the genteel act when it suits you."
Pendergast blinked innocently at DeGusta.
"I'm sorry, Lieutenant. I apologize for any unseemly behavior. It's simply that I can't stand pompous, bureaucratic individuals. I'm afraid I can become quite short with them."
He raised the book.
"It's a bad habit, but very hard to break."
17. The laboratory looked out over the East River and across to the warehouses and decaying industrial buildings of Long Island City. Louis Thoreau stood in the window and watched an enormous barge, piled with garbage and surrounded by countless seagulls, being pushed out to sea.
"Probably 1 minute's worth of New York City garbage," he thought.
Thoreau turned away from the window and sighed. He hated New York, but one had to make choices. The choice for him was enduring the city and working in one of the best genetic labs in the country, or working in some half-assed facility in a nice rural spot somewhere. So far, he'd chosen the city, but his patience was running out. He heard a low beeping, then the soft hiss of a mini-printer. The results were coming through. Another soft beep indicated the print job was finished. The $3 million Omega-9 parallel processing computer, which took up a series of large gray boxes along one wall, was now completely silent. Only a few lights indicated that anything was happening. It was a special, hardwired model designed for sequencing DNA and mapping genes. Thoreau had come to the lab 6 months before specifically because of this machine. He fetched the paper out of the bin and scanned it. The first page was a summary of the results, followed by a sequence of nucleic acids found in the sample. Next to those were columns of letters that identified primer sequences and mapped genes from the target group. The target group, in this case, was unusual. Big cats. They had asked for gene matches with Asiatic tiger, jaguar, leopard, bobcat. Thoreau had thrown in the cheetah, since its genetics were so well known. The outgroup chosen was, as usual, Homo sapiens, a control to check that the genetic matching process had been accurate and the sample sound. He scanned the summary.
"Well, this is complete bullshit," thought Thoreau.
The sample matched the outgroup a lot more than it matched the target group, the opposite of what should have happened. Only a 4% chance that the genetic material was from a big cat, but a 33% chance it was from a human being. 33%. Still low, but within the realm of probability. So that meant trying GenBank for a match. GenLab was the DNA database. The database, 200 gigs and growing, contained DNA sequences, primers, and mapped genes for thousands of organisms, from the Escherichia coli bacterium to Homo sapiens. He would run the data against the GenLab database and see just what this DNA was from. Something close to Homo sapiens, it looked like. Not high enough to be an ape, but maybe something like a lemur. Thoreau's curiosity was piqued. Till now, he didn't even know that his laboratory did work for the police department. What the hell made them think this sample came from a big cat, he wondered. The results ran to a hefty 80 pages. The DNA sequencer printed out the identified nucleotides in columnar format, indicating species, identified genes, and unidentified sequences. Thoreau knew that most of the sequences would be unidentified, since the only organism with a complete genetic map was the Escherichia coli bacterium. Thoreau glanced over the figures, then carried the paper over to his desk. With a few keystrokes on his Spark Station 10, Thoreau could access information from thousands of databases. If the Omega-9 did not have the information he sought, it would automatically dial into the Internet and find a computer that did. Scanning the printout more closely, Thoreau frowned. It must be a degraded sample, he thought. Too much unidentified DNA. He stopped flipping the pages. Here was something truly odd. The program had identified a large chunk of DNA as belonging to an animal named Hemidactylus tersicus. Now what the hell is that? Thought Thoreau. The biological nomenclature database told him. Common name, Turkish gecko. What? Thought Thoreau. He typed, expand. Hemidactylus tersicus, Turkish gecko. Original range, Northern Africa. Present biological range, Florida, Brazil, Asia Minor, Northern Africa. Medium-sized lizard of the gecko family, Gecconidae. Arboreal, nocturnal, lacking movable eyelids. Thoreau flicked out of the database while the information was still scrolling by. It was pure nonsense, obviously. Lizard DNA and human DNA in the same sample. But this wasn't the first time something like this had happened. You couldn't blame the computer, really. It was an inexact procedure, and only the smallest fractions of the DNA sequences of any given organism were known. He scanned down the printed list. About 50% of the matches were human, a very low proportion, assuming the subject was human, but not out of the question in a degraded sample. And there was always the possibility of contamination. A stray cell or two could ruin an entire run. This last possibility was looking more and more likely to Thoreau. Well, what can you expect from the NYPD? They couldn't even get rid of the guy who sold crack openly on the corner across from his apartment building. He continued his scan. Wait, he thought, here's another long sequence. Tarantola mauritanica. He punched up the database, entered the name. The screen read, Tarantola mauritanica. Wall gecko. Give me a break, Thoreau thought. This is some kind of a joke. He glanced at the calendar. April 1st was Saturday. He started to laugh. It was a very good joke. A very, very good joke. He didn't think old Buckholz had it in him. Well, he had a sense of humor, too. He started his report. Sample LA-33. Summary. Sample conclusively identified as Homo gecopiens. Common name, Gecko Man. When he finished the report, he sent it upstairs immediately. Then he went out for coffee, still chuckling. He was proud of how he'd handled it. He wondered where in the world Buchholz got his gecko samples from. Probably sold them in pet stores. He could see Buchholz blending up sample cells from two or three geckos in the ultra blender with a few drops of his own blood. "Let's see what our new man Tureau makes of this," he'd probably been thinking. Tureau, carrying the coffee up in the elevator, had to laugh out loud. He found Buchholz waiting for him in the lab. Only Buchholz wasn't laughing. 18. Wednesday. Frock sat in his wheelchair, dabbing his forehead with a Gucci handkerchief.
"Sit down, please," he said to Margot. "Thank you for coming so promptly. It's dreadful, just dreadful."
"The poor guard," she replied. Nobody in the museum was talking about anything else.
"Guard?"
Frock looked up.
"Oh, well, yes, quite a tragedy. No, I mean this."
He held up a memorandum.
"All sorts of new rules," said Frock. "Very inconvenient. Effective today, staff are only allowed in the building between 10 and 5. No working late, or on Sundays there will be guards stationed in each department. You'll be expected to sign in and out of anthropology each day. They're asking everybody to carry IDs at all times. Nobody will be allowed to enter or leave the museum without one." He continued reading. "Let's see, what else? Ah, yes. Try as much as possible to keep to your assigned section. And I'm supposed to tell you not to go into isolated areas of the museum alone. If you need to go somewhere, go with someone. The police will be interviewing everyone who works in the old basement. Yours is scheduled for early next week. And various sections of the museum are being posted as off-limits." He pushed the memo across the desk.
Margot saw a floor plan attached. The off-limits area is shaded in red.
"Don't worry," Frock continued. "I note your office is just outside the area."
Lovely, thought Margot, just outside where the murderer is probably lurking. This seems like a complicated arrangement, Professor Frock. Why didn't they just close the whole museum?
"No doubt they tried, my dear. I'm sure Winston talked them out of it. If this superstition exhibition doesn't open on schedule, the museum will be in deep trouble."
Frock held out his hand for the memo.
"Shall we consider this discussed? There are other things I wish to talk to you about."
Margot nodded. The museum will be in deep trouble. It seemed to her that it already was. Her office mate, along with half of the museum staff, had called in sick that morning. Those who did show up were spending most of their time at the coffee machines or photocopiers, trading rumors and staying in groups. If that wasn't bad enough, the museum's exhibit halls were nearly empty. The vacationing families, school groups, shouting children, the normal visitors were few and far between. Now the museum attracted mostly ghoulish rubberneckers.
"I was curious whether you'd obtained any of the plants for your chapter on the Kiribitu yet," Frock continued. "I thought it might be a useful exercise for both of us to run them through the extrapolator."
The telephone rang.
"Blast!"
Frock said, picking up the receiver.
"Yes,"
he demanded. There was a long silence.
"Is this necessary?"
Frock asked. Then he paused.
"If you insist,"
he concluded, dropping the phone into its cradle and heaving a great sigh.
"The authorities want me down in the basement. Heaven knows why. Somebody named Pendergast. Would you mind wheeling me down? We can chat along the way."
In the elevator, Margot continued. "I was able to get a few specimens from the herbarium, though not as many as I'd wanted. But I don't understand. You're suggesting we run them through the GSE?"
"Correct," Frock replied. "Depending on the condition of the plants, of course. Is there printable material?"
GSE stood for Genetic Sequence Extrapolator, the program being developed by Kawakita and Frock for analyzing genetic prints. "The plants are in good condition for the most part," Margot admitted. "But, Dr. Frock, I don't see what use they could be to the extrapolator." "Am I just jealous of Kawakita?" she wondered to herself. "Is that why I'm resisting?"
"My dear Margot, your situation is tailor-made,"
Frock exclaimed, using her first name in his excitement.
You can't replay evolution, but you can simulate it with computers. Perhaps these plants are allied genetically, along the same lines as the Kiribitu shamans have developed for their own classification. Wouldn't that make an interesting sidebar for your dissertation?
I hadn't thought of that, Margo said.
We're beta testing the program now, and this is exactly the kind of scenario we need,
Frock continued eagerly.
Why don't you talk to Kawakita about working together?
Margo nodded. Privately, she thought that Kawakita didn't seem like the type who wanted to share his spotlight, or even his research, with anybody. The elevator door opened onto a checkpoint manned by two police officers armed with shotguns.
Are you Dr. Frock? One asked.
Yes,
Frock replied irritably.
Come with us, please.
Margo wheeled Frock through several intersections, arriving at last at a second checkpoint. Behind the barricade stood two more policemen and a tall, thin man in a somber black suit, blonde white hair combed severely back from his forehead. As the policeman moved the barricade, he stepped forward.
You must be Dr. Frock, he said, extending his hand. Thank you for coming down. As I told you, I'm expecting another visitor, so I wasn't able to come by your office myself. Had I known you were...
He indicated the wheelchair with a nod. I would never have asked.
Special Agent Pendergast.
He held out his hand. Interesting accent, thought Margo. Alabama? This guy doesn't look anything like an FBI agent.
Quite all right,
said Frock, mollified by Pendergast's courtesy.
This is my assistant, Miss Green.
Pendergast's hand felt cool in Margo's grasp.
It's an honor to meet such a distinguished scientist as yourself, Pendergast continued. I hope time will permit me to read your latest book.
Frock nodded.
In it, do you apply the broken stick model of extinction to your theory of evolution, or the gambler's ruin scenario? I always thought that scenario backed up your hypothesis rather well, especially if you assume most genera start out close to the absorbing boundary.
Frock sat up in his wheelchair.
Well, I was planning to make certain references to that in my next book.
He seemed at a loss for words. Pendergast nodded to the officers, who readjusted the barrier.
I need your help, Dr. Frock, he said in a lower tone.
Certainly,
Frock said amiably. Margo was amazed at how quickly Pendergast had won Frock's cooperation.
I must ask, first of all, that this discussion be kept among ourselves for the time being, said Pendergast. May I have your assurance, and that of Miss Green?
Of course,
said Frock. Margo nodded. Pendergast motioned to one of the officers, who brought forward a large plastic bag marked evidence. From it he removed a small dark object, which he handed to Frock.
What you're holding, he said, is the latex cast of a claw found embedded in one of the children that were murdered last weekend.
Margo leaned forward for a closer look, repulsion struggling with curiosity. It was about an inch long, perhaps a little less, curved and jagged.
A claw?
Frock said, bringing the object close to his face and examining it.
Very unusual. But I'd guess it's a fake.
Pendergast smiled.
We haven't been able to identify its source, Doctor, but I'm not sure it's a fake. In the root canal of the claw, we found some matter, which is now being sequenced for DNA. Real DNA has been detected, but the results are still ambiguous. Our tests are continuing.
Frock raised his eyebrows.
Interesting.
Now this, said Pendergast, reaching into the bag and withdrawing a much larger object, is a reconstruction of the instrument that raked the same child.
He handed it to Frock. Margo looked at the cast with disgust. At one end, the latex was mottled and uneven, but at the other, details were clear and well-defined. It ended in three hooked claws, a large central claw and two shorter talons on either side.
Good heavens, said Frock. This looks saurian.
Saurian? Asked Pendergast.
Dinosaurian, said Frock. Typical ornithischian forelimb, I should say, with one difference. Look here. The central digital process is thickened enormously. while the talons themselves are undersized.
Pendergast raised his eyebrows in mild surprise.
Well, sir, he said slowly, we'd been leaning toward the big cats or some other mammalian carnivore. But surely you know, Mr. Pendergast, that all mammalian predators have 5 digits.
Of course, doctor, said Pendergast. If you would indulge me for a moment, I'd like to describe a scenario to you.
Certainly, said Frock.
There is a theory that the murderer is using this, he hefted the forelimb, as a weapon to rake his victims. We feel that what I'm holding might be the impression of an artifact of some kind, something made by a primitive tribe out of, say, a jaguar or a lion forelimb. The DNA appears to be degraded. It may be an old artifact collected by the museum a long time ago, then stolen.
Frock's head lowered until his chin was on his chest. The silence stretched out, broken only by the shuffling of the policemen by the barricade. Then Frock spoke.
The guard who was killed. Does his wounds show evidence of a broken or missing claw?
Good question, Pendergast said. See for yourself.
He slid his hand into the plastic bag and removed a heavy plaque of latex, a long rectangle with 3 jagged ridges down its middle.
This is a cast of one of the guard's abdominal wounds, Pendergast explained.
Margot shuddered. It was a vile-looking thing. Frock peered at the deep ridges intently.
The penetration must have been remarkable, but the wound shows no indication of a broken claw. Therefore, you are suggesting that 2 such artifacts are in use by the murderer?
Pendergast looked a little uncomfortable, but nodded. Frock's head sank once more. The silence went on for minutes.
Another thing, he suddenly said quite loudly. Do you see how the claw marks draw together slightly? How they are farther apart at the top than at the bottom?
Yes, said Pendergast.
Like a hand clenching into a fist. That would indicate flexibility in the instrument.
Granted, said Pendergast. Human flesh, however, is rather soft and easily distorted. We cannot read too much into these casts.
He paused.
Dr. Frock, is any artifact capable of doing this missing from the collection?
There is no such artifact in the collection, said Frock with a faint smile. You see, this comes from no living animal I've studied. Do you see how this claw has a conical shape, a deep, fully enclosed root? See how it tapers to an almost perfect tri-pyramidal cross-section near the top? This appears in only 2 classes of animal, dinosaur and bird. That is one of the reasons some evolutionary biologists think birds evolved from dinosaurs. I would say it is from a bird, except that it is far too large, thus dinosaurian.
He placed the latex claw in his lap and looked up again.
Certainly a clever person familiar with dinosaur morphology could have shaped a claw like this and used it as a tool for murder. I assume you have tested the original fragment to see if it indeed is composed of a genuine biological material, such as keratin, rather than being cast or carved from some inorganic material?
Yes, doctor, it is real.
And you are sure that the DNA was real and not simply blood or flesh from the victim?
Yes, Pendergast replied. As I said, it came from the root canal, not under the cuticle.
And what, pray tell, was the DNA from?
The final report isn't in yet. Pendergast stood up. Frock held up his hand.
Understood. But tell me, why aren't you making use of our own DNA laboratory here in the museum? We have facilities equal to that of anybody in the state.
Equal to anybody in the country, Doctor. But you must understand that our operation procedures forbid it. Could we be sure of the result if the tests were conducted at the crime scene, with perhaps the murderer himself operating the equipment?
Pendergast smiled.
I hope you'll forgive my persistence, Doctor, but would you be willing to consider the possibility that this weapon is constructed from relics belonging to the anthropology collection And to think about what artifact or artifacts this cast most closely resembles?
If you'd like, Frock replied.
Thank you. We can discuss it again in a day or so. Meanwhile, would it be possible to obtain a printed inventory of the anthropology collection? Frock smiled.
6 million items?
You can use the computer catalog, however. Would you like a terminal set up? Perhaps later, said Pendergast, replacing the latex plaque in the plastic bag. It's kind of you to offer. Our command post is currently in the unused gallery behind Reaper Graphics. Footsteps sounded behind them. Margot turned to see the tall form of Dr. Ian Cuthbert, deputy director of the museum, followed by the two officers from the elevator.
Look here. How long is this going to take?
Cuthbert was complaining. He stopped at the barricade.
Oh, Frock, so they've got you too. What a damn nuisance this is.
Frock nodded imperceptibly.
Dr. Frock, I'm sorry. This is the gentleman I'd been waiting for when we first spoke.
You're welcome to remain if you'd care to, Frock nodded again.
Now, Dr. Cuthbert, said Pendergast briskly, turning to the Scotsman, I asked you to come down because I'd like some information about this area behind me.
He indicated a large doorway.
The secure area? What about it? Surely someone else could...
Cuthbert began.
Ah, but my questions are for you,
Pendergast interrupted, politely but firmly.
Shall we step inside?
If it won't take much time, Cuthbert said. I've got an exhibition to mount.
Yes, indeed, said Frock, his tone faintly sardonic. An exhibition.
He motioned Margot to wheel him forward.
Dr. Frock?
Pendergast said politely.
Yes.
I wonder if I might have that cast back.
The copper-sheathed door to the museum's secure area had been removed, and a new steel one installed in its place. Across the hall was a small door labeled Pachydermy. Margot wondered how the staff had been able to fit huge elephant bones through it. Turning away, she wheeled Frock into the narrow walkway beyond the open door to the secure area. The museum kept its most valuable artifacts in small vaults on either side, sapphires and diamonds, ivory and rhinoceros horns heaped on racks like cordwood, bones and skins of extinct animals, Zuni war gods. Two men in dark suits stood at the far end, talking in low tones. They straightened up when Pendergast entered. Pendergast stopped at one open vault door, much like the others, sporting a large black combination knob, brass lever, and ornate decorative scrollwork. Inside, a bulb threw a harsh light across the metal walls. The vault was empty except for several crates, all of which were quite large except one. The smaller crate's lid was removed, while one of the larger crates was badly damaged, with excelsior stuffing protruding. Pendergast waited until everybody was inside the vault.
Allow me to provide some background, Pendergast said. The murder of the guard took place not far from this spot. It appears that afterward, the murderer came down the hallway just outside. The murderer attempted to break down the door that leads to the secure area. He may have tried before. The attempts were unsuccessful. At first, we weren't sure what the killer was after. As you know, there is a lot of valuable material in here.
Pendergast motioned to one of the policemen, who came over and handed him a piece of paper.
So we asked around, and found that nothing has come in or out of the secure area for 6 months, except these crates. They were moved into this vault last week. On your orders, Dr. Cuthbert.
Mr. Pendergast, allow me to explain, said Cuthbert.
One moment, if you please, said Pendergast. When we inspected the crates, we found something very interesting.
He pointed to the damaged crate.
Notice the slats. The 2x6s here are deeply scored by claw marks. Our forensic people tell me the marks on the victims were probably made by the same object or instrument.
Pendergast stopped and looked intently at Cuthbert.
I had no idea, said Cuthbert. Nothing had been taken. I merely thought that...
His voice trailed away.
I wonder, Doctor, if you could enlighten us as to the history of these crates.
That's easily explained, said Cuthbert. There's no mystery about it. The crates are from an old expedition.
I gathered that, Pendergast said dryly. Which expedition?
The Whittlesey expedition, Cuthbert replied.
Pendergast waited.